Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, if there's one word that sums up the life of Lily Bragg, it is the word colourful. The memoir of this Melbourne-born arts writer, titled My Dirty Shiny Life, has it all. Colourful characters, a colourful career, certainly colourful language. There's a lot of darkness there too, though. Years of rebellion, drug abuse, lying, cheating, mental illness, sexual oddities, even suicide attempts. But Lily's dark story turns a sharp corner when, against all the odds, she meets a person by the name of Jesus. She's on the line now. Lily Grace Bragg, welcome to Open House.
Thank you, Sheridan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to talk to you. We need to certainly say that this book is certainly one colourful book. It probably deserves an R rating, probably by your own admission, hey?
Yes, I think it probably deserves an R rating indeed.
Yeah, and there's a reason why.
An R rating that becomes kind of G.
Yes, definitely G towards the end there. Let's talk about the story then, because it is quite a story you've had. Let's start off with the family background that you actually grew up in, because I guess people who read your columns in the papers and have seen your other work, and of course maybe you've caught some of your stand-up comedy shows in the past, may not realize just the full history that you've had. Tell me about Mum. Tell me about Dad. They weren't the couple you'd expect to get together, were they?
They were very ill-matched and ill-fated, I think. And my father was a very handsome, swaggering, talented musician and mechanic, and spent most of his life as a career criminal. And he was borderline sociopathic, and he was very much a narcissist. And he looked like Elvis when Elvis was young, and then he looked like Elvis at the end, but more of a toxic Buddha.
Okay.
And my mother is a classical music playing and loving academic, and she met him when she was 18 and he was 19. She auditioned for his band as a saxophone player. She was a child prodigy at Melbourne University when she was 16, and her scholarship had run out, and she needed to get some part-time work to help further her studies, and she met Dad, and I was conceived in the back seat of a Zephyr behind St Kilda's Esplanade Hotel. Mm-hmm. And it was in the early 60s, and my father had another girl pregnant at exactly the same time, and his father said to him, "You've got to choose one of these girls and marry them." And he chose my mother. And then she spent 12 years with him, and for maybe 11 of those years trying to get away from him.
Yeah, and in fact, your dad became very, very violent, didn't he? At one point,
yes.
Even pulling out a gun and firing it in front of your mum and all sorts of things.
Yeah, threatening to kill her in front of us when we were young children, ramming us into a telephone pole when she tried to leave him when I was about 10 years old, and pulling her out by the hair and being very violent in a road and leaving her there after kicking her and taking my sister, myself and my baby brother away with him while we were left looking at her and on the road. So there was a lot of trauma when I was young. But paradoxically, our household was filled with music and laughter and good food, but we were always subject to his rages, which were pretty extreme.
Yeah. So looking back, what did you pick up from Mum and Dad, for good or ill, that was picked up in your own personality?
Well, for good and ill, the ability to have a raging, screaming argument with someone and then pretend nothing had happened and act normal, inverted commas, afterwards. I still have the ability to do that, and it's something that I try and work on, because the volatility of temper is what I learned, that you could be screaming something hideous at someone and then be quite loving and pleasant afterwards, and that's a very strange thing to grow up with, I think, and it's a hard thing to shake if it's been in your foundations.
Yes, yeah. This is Open House. Lily Bragg, the arts writer and stand-up comic and sometime actor, she's with us now. We're talking about her memoir. It's called My Dirty Shiny Life. Let's move forward a few years. Despite those rough beginnings, you went on to study at uni, you ended up working in all kinds of arts roles, singing, stand-up comic, as I mentioned, sometime actor, arts writer. So you really took to the arts pretty quickly, didn't you?
Yeah, and I think that was my mother's influence primarily, in that she has always been a voracious reader, and we always had books as kids and loved reading and music as well, because both of them were musicians, and we grew up with lots of music, and we played heaps of instruments and sang, and so it was just a natural thing. And I think that if you grow up in a household that does have a, like, quite a few secrets and is violent. You can either become withdrawn and introverted, or you can be like I was, which was a bit of a clown and a performer, and to be able to distract people by entertaining them.
So behind the entertainment, though, everything's starting to fall apart because you get into this cycle of alcohol and then drugs, and you really got into heroin and everything. Just what was the first introduction? What was the attraction? And just how bad did it get?
Well, I think that I was... There's part of me that thinks that I am, because we all are the product of our parents in so many ways, there's that part of me that can go into any strange city anywhere in the world and sniff the breeze and go straight to the underbelly of the city and feel very at home there, courtesy of my dad, or it can be from my mother and I'll go to a library and somewhere calming and peaceful and nature-driven. And so that's always been part of me. But I got my first, and I say like being hit with a big stick, a whack of depression when I was 16 for a couple of months. And I'd been sexually promiscuous from an early age, but I should say that I mean, it just sounds like such misery memoir stuff, but my paternal uncle, Bob, molested me when I was a three-year-old girl. And so, and I think that in that happening, it gave me a very skewed and false sense of what it was to be, you know, of what sex was, all those things. Yeah. And he wasn't a violent pedophile, but he was definitely a rampant pedophile. There were lots of other people he abused as well. And so I had that, as well as the violent stuff going on, combined with being good at school. And then once my mother had left my father, we had a bit of sanity in our household and peace. And so we kind of had a much more normalized existence. But we went to a small country town and there was lots of binge drinking, and sex was something that people, you know, very few people weren't engaging in it as teenagers. And particularly in my peer group. And I did those kind of things very mindlessly. And then I started to drink, but not seriously until my 20s, and a bit of binge drinking. And I think that what I responded to with alcohol and with drugs was that not only the feeling of being intoxicated or high, but anaesthetizing, a lot of pain in me that had never been solved or cleansed or worked on in a way. Yeah. And in my 30s, I tried heroin, which was ridiculous, but it had been something that I'd wanted to try. And all my artistic heroes had been heroin addicts.
That's right,
I neglected to actually understand that each and every one of them had lamentable personal lives and were, you know, terrible narcissists and abusive and whatever, whether it was Billie Holiday or Miles Davis or Jean-Michel Basquiat, whoever I was thinking that was fabulous. I didn't realize that they mostly had miserable emotional lives. And I think part of me thought it was cool. It was such a delusion. And the thing is, once you take heroin and it gets a hold on you, it ends up just wanting you alone in a room and dead, basically.
And speaking of which, I mean, there were numerous suicide attempts. Was it due to the drugs? Was it just all those things spiralling in together?
Well, I had a psychiatrist assess me after one of my many failed suicide attempts, and she said, Lily, you have drug-induced depression, anxiety, mood disorder, and you'd had a form of psychosis going on with this last suicide attempt. And I remember thinking at the time, what would you know? And she said, you need to get clean, you need to go to rehab, and you need to get into a 12-step program. And I thought that she was insane, but I was the one who was completely insane. And it wasn't until I did get clean, and I didn't really last very long at any kind of rehab, but until I got clean, and I very much resisted the notion of handing myself over to a higher power of my own understanding. That to me seemed completely nonsensical, because I'd had a little bit of exposure to church Christianity as a child, very minimal, and ever since then I'd become a resolute secular liberal humanist. And I was agnostic. I couldn't say I was an atheist, but I was definitely agnostic. I wanted proof if there was going to be something. And after repeated suicide attempts, I just thought, I remember sitting on a rehab bed in Wagga and sitting there thinking, God, if you exist, can you give me a sign? And I got nothing. Nothing. Big fat nothing, Sheridan.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Because you got nothing then.
But as nothing then.
As we'll find in just a minute, something came. Now, how many people, if we just simply paused your story at that particular moment, would say, okay, I've been through the same thing. I've gone through some, you know, maybe it's been child abuse. Maybe it's been the drugs. Maybe it's been the licentious lifestyle as a result of the stuff in my past. And I've called out to God and I've kind of said, okay, God, if you're there, I need a sign. And nothing's happened. I wonder whether we just pause for a moment now and say, just wait. Just wait. This is Open House right across the nation. Lily Bragg, arts writer, journalist, performer, is with us. Her memoir is called My Dirty Shiny Life. We're hearing about it. And I guess, yeah, we have kind of focused on the dark side now. But then there's this bright, shining switch around at the end of the memoir. You reach rock bottom. You'd lost all your friends, your possessions.
Yes, I'd lost custody of my son. I was incapable of looking after him.
At one stage, you actually offered your son a drink of something, didn't he? He actually told you, no, Mom, I'm actually a kid.
Yeah, when I was using drugs, and I think I was on methadone at the time, and I decided to reward myself for being clean, not clean, but pretend clean, by using heroin again, and I had a bottle of $500 Krug rosé champagne that someone had given me in the fridge, and I remember opening it by myself at about 2 o'clock in the morning and thinking, oh, I should give some to Rudy. He was 8 years old, I think, because I was completely deluded and drug induced, and not that that's any excuse, because most people would actually think not to give it to the children. But I walked into his bedroom and woke him up and said, Rudy, you've got to try this. It's French champagne. Who knows when you could ever have it again? And he was all sleepy and he said, no, Mama, I don't drink. I'm a kid. I don't drink liquor. And he always was a wise child. But it was that kind of scenario of the hedonistic, unthinking parent with the child being the moral compass and it being completely inverted and ridiculous.
Yeah, and then your editor sends you off to go and write a profile story on none other than Marina Pryor.
That is true. Now, but I should say that Marina and I have been friends for years and years, and we met when we were 18, and we lived in a series of shared households together, and then she was, you know, got her big break and was discovered and went on tour around the country, and so I didn't see her as frequently, but would remain friends. But through the height of my addiction, I didn't see her for maybe 3 or 4 years, and I definitely didn't tell her that I'd become a heroin addict, and I was never homeless, as in living on the streets, but I'd lost my home and I'd lost my possessions and gone bankrupt, and I was still desperately unhappy and really prone to just terrible depression. And I'd ruined pretty much incredible career chances and relationships. I was just a hurricane of destruction and self-destruction. But somehow I managed to get this profile story for the Sunday Age up on Marina, and she was doing a show called Witches of Eastwick at the time, and I hadn't seen her. And so it was a lovely reunion, and we've always had the ability to pick up where we left off. And I said, what's different about you? There's something. You're you, but you're more you. And she looked at me with shining eyes and a really warm, big smile, and she said, it's God. And I was horrified. Absolutely horrified. I thought, oh, I love you, you crazy piece of elastic, but I don't want anything to do with that. And then something in me just poured out everything that had happened, and she was weeping and I was weeping, and it was really weird, because other people were kind of walking past us as part of the rehearsal process, and we were acting like we were in our own little force field. And then she said, can I pray for you? And I remember being doubly horrified, and then thinking, just having this little flash saying, well, nothing else has worked, maybe this will. And I went, oh, if you must. And that was the beginning of me, she and her husband, Peter, and their family, their children. I'd just go out there to their place, and every week, they just showered me with love, and they walked their talk. They walked, you know, their faith, in that they were just so loving and unjudgmental and just great friends. Mm. And they were really living out Christ's message to reach out to someone who needed it so desperately. And in the end, I went to church with them. And
yeah, which was a bit of a torturous process for you, I believe.
Awful for me again. You know, it broke out into a hot, cold sweat. Everyone was smiling at me. I thought they looked like Stepford Wives. And it was at a happy, clappy Pentecostal church in Box Hill. Mm. And I was like, I can't do this. And the music made me go, oh, everything. But in retrospect, I think that that was just a spiritual attack to keep me away from God, because God was the one thing that I desperately, desperately needed to be able to get well. And I was a broken-hearted person, like, you know, too many of us in the world are. My heart responded to God before my intellect did, and then my intellect argued with my heart for a long time.
Now, tell me about that turning point, because so you went to church with Marina and Peter, and at some stage, then you, which is often the case for a Pentecostal evangelical church, there'll be an offer. If you want to give your life to Jesus Christ, if you want to recognize you need him, put up your hand, come forward, or whatever. You came forward, you prayed what we often call the sinner's prayer.
I must say, Sharon, that it had been 3 months of going to church on and off and grappling and reading, and people thrusting books like Lee Strobel's The Case for Christ and C.S. Lewis, The Problem of Pain, and things. And I started opening up to a world of Christian writers.
Did that help, by the way?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And also C.S. Lewis's conversion experience. I was so much like him, never a more reluctant convert. Before, I was grappling with it and thinking, can't I please be a Buddhist, something cool? Because I totally subscribe to the worldly view that Christians are, you know, that the church is responsible for most of the world's ills, that religion has been the cause of the worst suffering in history. You know, I had a whole heap of precepts and ideas that I was stubbornly clinging to, as opposed to just the simple truth that Jesus loved me and had died for me.
Yeah, there you go. So you pray this prayer. Now what happened after that? The prayer basically saying, yes, I am a sinner. I've let go of you. I've forgotten you. I've been wandering my own way. I want to come back. Thank you for dying for me, for forgiving my sins. Here's my life. What happened after that?
Well, I remember driving into the city with Marina's husband, Peter, and we went out for lunch. And we had gone from Box Hill into Southgate, in the city of Melbourne. Mm. And I looked and I thought, what's wrong with my eyes? And because the trees and the leaves were greener, the sky was bluer. Mm. I was seeing things in a kind of intense versicolor, as though a veil had been lifted off my eyes that I'd never been looking through my whole life. It's so cliched and kind of, I know it sounds a bit lame, but really that's exactly what happened.
That's what
everything
happened to me.
Did it?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, everything amplified in a way where I just went, and when I realised that I'd given my heart to Jesus, and that because I need to be someone, I like being told what to do in some ways, and so I use the Bible as my instruction manual on how to behave, because I'd spent such an incredible amount of time really, I mean, I think of the way I've lived most of my life, it was not consciously, and through this kind of default setting rather than with any kind of design, and so many decisions and things I believed, I realised were just completely wrong. Mm. Like if I had my time over bringing up my son again, I would never have done with him what I did.
Yeah.
I think it's just because my moral compass was so skewed and so off kilter that I just thought that I was being, you know, impossibly cool, and that I was bringing up a really cool kid. And to his credit, despite my lamentable parenting, he's a great human being, and is really together in a way that I sadly wasn't for him when he was growing up.
Yeah, that's the good news. I just love hearing your story, Lily, because, you know, it just shows that the fact that God is in the business of restoring and restoration.
Absolutely.
and rebuilding us.
Yeah, I was so wretched, Sheridan. I was a liar. I was a cheat. I was a thief. I stole from people. I did, you know, and the reason that my book can be as honest as it is because I hope that I'm no longer that person. You know, I actually try as much as possible, rigorously honest.
Yeah.
And that to me now, to steal from someone is anathema. Whereas when I was using heroin, I was so delusional that I actually thought it was my right, because if they weren't going to give it to me, I could take it.
You're still in the arts world and still writing within the arts world, which some, at least part of the arts world, often is kind of still back where you were. How have your friends and your colleagues and all your contacts within the arts world responded to this newfound faith of yours, which is now a few years old, by the way?
Well, I've been a Christian for 8 years now. And, well, a lot of people were horrified. Not in my professional life so much, because my Christianity informs my writing, in that if I ever do a profile story on someone as a journalist, I always ask them what they believe in. Mm. I'm fascinated by it. And I think one of the saddest things is when people don't believe in anything. And because I believe, and a friend of mine who's a worship pastor has got this theory that I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I think it's absolutely true, that we're all created to worship.
Yeah.
Individually.
Absolutely.
And for me as a Christian, I believe I was created to worship God. But for non-Christians, people will worship things and prove it over and over, whether it's mammon, whether it's things
people.
Of the flesh, people, yeah. Idol worship. I mean, look at our celebrity culture. There it is straight away, because people are worshiping. So my Christian, as a reviewer now, I don't give bad reviews. Sometimes I'll be constructively critical, but I won't write about something if I don't like the show.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas before I was a Christian, I wouldn't have had any problem being scathing about something
Rip
or someone in public.
Yeah.
Whereas now I just won't do that, because who am I to break their shabby artistic heart, is what I say. And also there's that part of me that when I was a performer, I know what it's like to be reviewed, and I really don't want to be...
Yeah.
And so I kind of bowed out of being a critic's critic,
yes.
And I feel pleased about that. But I think people, as far as friends go, I still have my gay friends, and we have lots of discussions about theology, God, religion, church. But I have a whole Christian group of friends too, and I belong to a prayer group called the Edners, and we've been meeting weekly for 5 years now, and we've got a really high successful rate of answered prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And we pray for lots of people and lots of different things and situations, and it's just one of the great privileges and pleasures of my life to be involved in that group. And I believe in the power of prayer, and lots of my non-believing humanist secular friends ask the Edners to pray for them.
There you go.
And I think that that's pretty interesting.
It is. Well, Lily, the thing that strikes me is that what you said about Marina Pryor when you saw her after she had come to faith was, you are you, but you're more you. And it seems like maybe that's been the case for you. God has made you you, but he's, now that he's taken hold of you and taken hold of your heart, started to rebuild it, he's made you more you. You've still got your sense of humour, still got
Absolutely.
Your wonderful ability to tell stories and communicate and all of that. But now it's the new, renewed you.
Well, I was worried, Sheridan, when I became a Christian, that I might, you know, become beige and get a comb over and wear socks and sandals with long shorts.
No Christians actually dress like that or look like that.
That's what I was worried about. And God, in his wonderful grace and mercy, said, no, Lily, you can still look like you.
You can still look like you. I think you'd look nice in a comb over. But anyway, wonderful talking to you, Lily. So good to hear your story.
Thank you, Sheridan. It was really delightful to speak to you too.
Yeah, we'll catch up in the future, I'm sure. Lily Bragg, arts writer, journalist, performer, and author now of this. It is colourful. It's expects some pretty hard language, but you can see why now, can't you? Just the story that she's had, the memoir. It's called My Dirty, Shiny Life.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.